This sound you're hearing right now is a Trilogy 100 BiPAP ventilator. It's the machine Alice Wong uses to live. And Alice doesn't want you to feel sorry for her or treat her any differently. Her disability is just a fact. But Alice does want you to see her and the millions of others who live with disabilities. Alice and I met last spring when I interviewed her about a ventilator shortage that had forced healthcare workers to make these choices about who got life-saving care. And Alice was basically shouting from the rooftops, "Hey, don't forget about those who depend on ventilators or need extra care during this pandemic. Basically, our lives matter too." I'm Tanya Mosley, and on this episode of Truth Be Told, how do we shed ourselves of our ableist mindsets that prioritizes the lives of the able-bodied over those who live with disabilities?
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
I really need your help.
I need your help.
I need your help.
We're joined by Alice Wong. She's the founder of Disability Visibility. It's an online community that shares and amplifies the stories and voices of those with disabilities. And she's also the editor of a new book under the same name. Alice has written passionately about her life and the lives of others in the disability community for many years now. Alice, welcome to Truth Be Told.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight.
How are you?
Still alive, I guess. I think that's the best answer for now. It is some year.
You know, in the preface of your book, you write that you always dreamed when you were younger of being able to elevate the voices of people with disabilities. And man, you are doing it in such a rich way. I mean, every platform out there you are on. How does it feel?
You know, I feel a lot of gratitude to number one, still be around and in this world and having a house and having the tools and resources to do what I want to do. It's been just such a privilege to be connected with other people and to learn from them, and also just have this chance to present this collection of stories that I think captures some of the lived experiences of being disabled in the 21st century.
Yeah. On your site, Disability Visibility, there's a message from the future, the Disabled Oracle Society, where you're giving a talk. It's the year 2029. And we're still living with the coronavirus. And you say that just like now, the world is hostile toward people like yourself. Other humans believe disabilities are something that needs to be fixed, to be eliminated. The pushing back against this narrative is the basis of your work, really. I mean, it's at the foundation of your work. You're constantly having to say, not only I matter, but I don't need to be fixed. Do you feel like we're any closer as a society to understanding that?
I want to be hopeful. You know, I truly am kind of tired of having to, like, make the case that my life has worth and quality the way it is, you know, just as it is right now. This has been centuries at the making, but even right now with the coronavirus, you know, we really have seen who is valued, and clearly Black, Brown, Indigenous people are considered disposable. Disabled people are considered disposable when we hear the media and hear our elected officials, you know, use terms like acceptable losses and, like, you know, high-risk people, and just this kind of, you know, help it push to open up schools, to restart the economy, when, oh, it's only these these folks that are going to die or be impacted. I feel like this is a real moment for people to kind of try to ask questions. Yeah. Like, why are these things even happening? I feel like this has been a really amazing moment. Hopefully that's people will understand, you know, why institutions are broken, why abolition is absolutely necessary now, or like, you know, why reform or replicate systems that have harmed people for, you know, forever. So I think this is, if there's anything to come out of this, I hope that it is a chance for people to really re-examine, like, why are things the way they are? And, you know, why can't we imagine a better world for all of us?
You know, you've talked a lot about all of the inequalities that have been laid bare, and you talked about the inequalities, the parallels we see between Black, Brown, and Indigenous people and those in the disability community. What parallels do you see in this moment with the disability community and BLM?
Oh my goodness, so many. I think, you know, I really look toward Black disabled people who really are leading the way in terms of speaking out about these issues. And, you know, I try to, you know, do as much as I can to center their activism and writing, because they are the ones who should be leading this conversation. But I do think, you know, what I've learned over the years is that, you know, disabled people are part of every single community.
That's right.
And that white supremacy is absolutely bound up with ableism.
Say more on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think we think about all these different forms of systemic inequality, the school to prison pipeline. When we look at the prison industrial complex, you know, it's not just about race, but clearly about class, gender, disability. You know, the fact that Black and Brown students are disproportionately disciplined in schools, that says a lot. There's a significant population of people who are incarcerated with disabilities as well, all kinds of, you know, invisible and, you know, apparent disabilities. So, you know, I also see parallels and connections clearly when it comes to abolition, because, you know, if we think about systems that incarcerate people, institutions that trap people, it's not just prisons, it's also detention centers, nursing homes, assisted living centers, you know, psychiatric hospitals. So, you know, all of our freedom and liberation is tied up with one another. So the way white supremacy operates, you know, it definitely does uphold ableism, and ableism definitely upholds, you know, white supremacy as well, because it's all toward this centering of their own group that leaves somebody out and harms somebody.
This is so powerful. You know, I have thought about this deeply when it comes to the school to prison pipeline, but not in the way that you just laid it out for us about the different ways of learning, the different ways of learning and the system and how it doesn't lend or open itself or even accommodate those different modes and ways of learning. And that just furthers the school to prison pipeline in a profound way.
Yeah, I feel like there's a real disciplining of what it means to be, you know, quote unquote, normal. You know, when we think about normal behavior, which is often racialized, but also very much based on a non-disabled norm. So when people kind of are different, they navigate through the world, they communicate differently. You know, clearly that's when these points of violence, you know, often happens. And, you know, we've seen a lot of people who've been killed by police who've had disabilities as well, who are Black and disabled. But very often their disability, that part of their identity is not really explicated. But I think this is why Black disabled activists and leaders, you know, have been doing this work for a really long time and have been talking about disability justice that is really part of, you know, racial and social justice.
You're our wise one this week. So we have a question from an anonymous listener.
Dear Truth Be Told, I have a rare brain condition called Chiari malformation, and I don't know what ways I can educate my friends and family without making them feel like I'm shoving information down their throats. Please help.
And for those of you who don't know, Chiari malformation is a condition where brain tissue extends into the spinal canal, and some of the symptoms include severe head and neck pain, muscle weakness, dizziness, and problems with balance. Alice, what's your advice to this person?
First of all, I want to thank this anonymous listener for asking this question. And, you know, clearly, I don't know what it's like to have this disability. But I will say that it can be very difficult, especially if you have a disability that's not apparent. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that that might be part of the issue where, as I've also learned from other friends of mine, one of the biggest challenges for people with invisible disabilities is the fact that their families and friends can't recognize, you know, how serious things are, mm-hmm. or oftentimes don't believe that, you know, like, you look healthy. Hmm. Well, you look fine. And I think that's part of the challenge. And I think that's something really difficult. So I think that's often one of the kind of big sources of emotional labor that disabled people have to do all the time, is to always like, no, actually, this is really difficult. Or, you know, no, what you see is not, you know, it's not obvious. And I think the advice I would have is maybe two suggestions. Number one, it might be useful to educate folks around you in smaller chunks. Mm-hmm. So maybe if there's a situation, you don't need to go into like the full-on explanation, but maybe something that's specific to an experience you've had with your friend or family. Maybe you're having a really bad day related to your disability. And then you can just say, hey, let me tell you why this is happening. And, you know, giving enough information that helps them understand without having to give this long lecture, because I think it's, you know, we all know lectures don't work. I would also say that having some information prepared like ahead of time, like just, I love Google Docs so much.
Yeah. So talking points.
If you want to do this, prepare like a sheet of information. Whatever you want to share about your disability or condition, things that they should know about as a background, and just send it to them and say, hey, if you want to learn more about what I'm going through and just some of the basics, here it is. And just offer that as a resource. Mm-hmm. So you yourself do not have to constantly repeat.
Right.
That's also very exhausting. I would definitely pace yourself and be selective about when you feel like it's too much to explain.
Yeah.
Because that's also draining on you.
How do you manage that? How do you manage the emotional labor and exhaustion of that comes with educating people?
Yeah, I feel like over time I've had less patience for people.
Yeah.
And I think that's
age, right?
Yeah, too. That's definitely age. Like, and I think that's okay too. I think it's gently pushing back at people and say, here is some information. The information is already out there for many of the questions that I receive. So I would also invite them to do the work, because I also feel like this is not my responsibility, even though I think with the listener, it does feel like an immense responsibility, right? Like this is something that you have to do often just to make yourself understood and heard. But also, you know, when you get to that point where it gets to be a little bit too much, I also welcome you to consider that maybe it's time to also gently challenge people to also do the labor as well. We all have so much privilege and implicit bias and things that we all need to learn and unlearn. Like, I'm constantly trying to unlearn things that, you know, that I need to be more understanding of.
Man, so, that's so powerful about there's so many things we have to unlearn, just as much as what we have to learn. I mean, what you're saying gets to this idea of folks who are ableist, and maybe they aren't even aware that they're ableist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're all works in progress. And, you know, it's always this idea that I don't expect people to be like 100%, like, you know, changing everything about themselves, but trying to make some sort of commitment to be more open about things. You know, going back to the listener, you know, there are times where I felt hurt or excluded by friends and family members who are not disabled, and it's just so frustrating all the time to kind of educate people. So, like, I think one of the ways to try to reach people is to really be honest about how their actions are impacting you.
Hmm.
You know, maybe that's start with that first, and then go with the educational piece, but really kind of get them to understand how deeply affected you are by their behavior or their words or their actions, and then say, you know, what you just said to me, you know, you may not realize it, but it was really painful, and this is why. But I think, you know, trying to get people to understand why they should learn more is also helpful, too. And it can be a lot, but I think, you know, this is often a very gradual process, too. Like, these things don't happen overnight.
What do you think about the idea of letting people know how they can support you? I'm thinking about, I have a friend who has an invisible disability, and when she was diagnosed, she actually let us know, this is what my condition is, and this is how you can support me, because my life is going to change. Because I do think many people who are ableist and they are not aware they are, or they're just not aware, there's a feeling of, well, what am I to do? Am I to continue as if nothing has ever changed? knowing this information, how can I support this person that I love? And it might be, you can support me by educating yourself. You know, it may be something as simple as that, or it may be something more on the ways that you can support this person, both physically or emotionally.
Yeah, and I feel like this is where, you know, honesty and vulnerability is really important. And sometimes the people who are disabled or, you know, chronically ill are not at that place yet where they feel permission or okay with saying, like, this is what I need right now. And this may change in the future, but at this point in time, you know, I need you all to, like, back off, or I need you all to, like, stop making assumptions, or I need you all to stop feeling sorry for me. You know, just like, it's hard to get to that point yet to where you can actually articulate that stuff without being fearful of the response of your friends. Because I think, you know, part of being honest is also accepting that there will be family members and friends that won't get it, or that are scared. And, you know, that's one thing about being disabled is you really do, it's almost a filter to where you see the people who really have your back. Your relationship with them may change, but if they really care about you, they're going to be with you, or just learn to adjust, you know. And it's not easy for everybody involved, but I think for friends and family who are really, who want to continue be part of this person's life, to really just like let the individual take the lead. But part of it is also be sure that to let them know that you're there for them.
You know, I mean, in addition to the message that has really touched me in my heart that you give over and over of, I don't need to be fixed. The other thing that really resonates deeply with me, you talked about it in your book, you have a website about it, the yearning for love, care, intimacy, sex. It's all so important, and it's beautifully told in various ways throughout all of your platforms. Why was it an important thing for people to know and understand? Because I think that, like, intellectually, we know we all need love, but to say, no, you need to understand that disabled people experience all of these things and need to feel all of these things too.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is almost so, like, important to say that to really be who we are, you know, to show up completely and to be unapologetic about it. And part of it is not to defend our existence, you know, it's coming from a place of, this is who I am, take me as I am. And I think that's really still missing. And I would say the mainstream understandings and narratives and representation of disabled people, because we're still set up in this position to always cater to the center, to provide this idea of empathy or awareness, as if, like, from the outset, we're less than human.
You're other.
Right. And then I'd rather center us and invite people in. So it's kind of a recentering of the people that I care about and the people that I think more people should care about. But at the same time, really challenging. I mean, I don't even think it's radical, but yet, in a lot of ways, this book is radical because it was really written, it was really edited with the purpose of pleasing disabled audiences. And I don't know if you've kind of came away with that from the book, because, you know, in the introduction, I do challenge, like, non-disabled readers, saying, like, you know, there are things in this book that might make you uncomfortable. There's maybe terms you've never heard of. And that's precisely the point, you know? They don't have to explain it to you, because we should be able to present ourselves as we are.
Mm-hmm. The book most definitely did this, Alice. I mean, I was able to sit down with this book many times throughout the last few weeks, and I felt like I was, I learned something each and every time. And ultimately, it's those two things that I keep bringing up for you that just kept coming back up for me. And it's the unlearning of what we've spent our lives being conditioned to learn, to know, but it's not reality. It's not reality, this idea that the centering has to be this heteronormative white person, that we all coexist in this world together, and we all should be able to see each other in the totality of who we are. So thank you so much, Alice, for your work. It really is tremendous.
Thank you, Tanya. I think every time we've talked, I've really appreciated our conversations, and I'm just so gratified to hear that you enjoyed the book and that you got something out of it. I think it's always that kind of low-key anxiety when you put something out of the world. You just don't know how you have all the right intentions and secret hopes, but it does seem that right now, during this pandemic, it's really feeling a need and feeling a hunger. And I think this has been such a humbling experience, and it gives me joy to know that it gives other people joy.
Thank you, Alice, so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
That's Alice Wong of Disability Visibility. On our next episode of Truth Be Told, I'm talking with author Bassi Igbe about one of those invisible disabilities, bipolar disorder.
It feels amazing and exhilarating, and you feel powerful, and you feel like the most amazing person in the entire world, right? For a little bit, but once you stay up there, it gets frightening because there's no down, and it feels like there's no ground beneath your feet.
That's next time on Truth Be Told.
Hey TBT fam, I'm Susie Racho, and I'm the editor of Truth Be Told. KQED is hoping to learn more about how you listen to podcasts and what you love about them. So if you've got a few minutes, we'd really appreciate you filling out our podcast survey. Head over to kqed.org/podcast survey. Your answers will help us at Truth Be Told. And really, it's going to help all the folks making podcasts at KQED continue to make shows that matter to you. That's kqed.org/podcast survey. Thanks so much.
Truth Be Told is produced by Susie Racho, Issa Mendoza, and Katie McMurrin. KQED's leadership team includes Erica Aguilar, Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. And as always, a big thanks to Kiana Mogadam. Truth Be Told is a production of KQED in San Francisco. I'm Tanya Mosley.